is Lena Live with my very interesting guest, Gerard Artson. I have to confess that the subject of the show is not terribly familiar to myself. So I'm very much looking forward to learn, to be very honest, to cut somewhat of skepticism, which I did develop over the years with many, many other people, regarding ufology. I think Mr. Gerard Artson is one of the best specialists and incredibly devoted not only to his subject, but particularly to his devotion to the one of the greatest discoverer scientists and incredibly talented visionary is George Adamski. I had the privilege to get some reading and some interesting information from the book by Mr. Artson, and I'm going to invite him momentarily to our discussion. But I need to say that if someone who's listening to this program might have some strong criticism, that means that our program is very successful, because this is about thoughts, knowledge, and about some controversy. And controversy attracts curiosity. So on this note, I'm going to invite to our discussion Mr. Gerard Artson. Gerard, you're on. How are you? Yes. All from Netherlands.
Yes, from Amsterdam. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
It is more than pleasure. I'd like to ask you an immediate question about ufology. How much of it is real? How much of it is fantasy? And how much we can profit from it scientifically in our modern world?
Oh, I think you're starting with the largest question of them all. If we look at ufology at the moment, you can find almost anything, any brand of fantasy, any brand of fear, and any brand of speculation, especially now with the internet, of course. The opinions and the speculations are running wild in that respect. So it is a very you have to take great care when you move in this field to know what might be real and what could be discarded. I think personally, having looked at the many different aspects and angles of this area, ufology, I think a very safe place to start is with the early contactees, the people who, especially in the 1950s, first saw flying saucers or UFOs, as they're called now, and also claimed to have had contact with people from these UFOs who manned them and who, very much like our pilots flying airplanes. Why do I think that the early contactees, and then I'm talking about especially George Adamski, because he's the subject of my book, but there have been several others, and one other notable example being Wilbur Smith from Canada, who was a government researcher in the field. But why do I think that they are especially reliable? They started to, because they saw UFOs, they witnessed the UFOs, some of them have been aboard, some have contacted people from the UFOs, as I said, naively. They experienced what they experienced, and they started to tell the world. George Adamski became world famous with with his experiences, the books that he wrote about his experiences and his talks. And he had many, many people, especially in government and in the military, worried because he was so enormously popular. And his message really struck a chord with people. And as soon as the authorities saw that he became so popular and he had such a wide, huge, worldwide audience, they decided to do something about it because the powers that be did not really want to face a populace that would say, hey, you know, why do we need you if the space people are here with their advanced technology and their message of brotherhood, because it was essential in the experiences of the early contactees. Why would we live in constant fear of each other? You know, this, we're talking about the Cold War period between especially the USA and the Soviet Union, of course. Psychological warfare. It was a cold war, as it was called, but it could ignite into a hot war any moment. And of course, everybody will know that at the time, both the USA and the Soviet Union had nuclear bombs, atom bombs to their disposal. So you know, there was a psychological threat and a lot of fear. And people really, really listened to and had an open ear for the messages that the early contactees and George Adamski were bringing to the world. And so the authorities had every reason to be worried about it. And from that time on, say from the mid-1950s, they started to make to ridicule them, to defame them, to make sure that people started to doubt their stories. They did everything, even if it wasn't the people highest up in the governments themselves, but some secretive agencies within governments that maybe the presidents didn't even know about. And those attempts were very, very effective, because in the 1960s, in the early 1960s, George Adamski was already, you know, considered, especially in the media, as a crackpot from California. And we all know, of course, the example of the crashed flying saucer in Roswell, New Mexico, that first made the headlines in the evening newspapers. And then in the morning newspapers the next day, the story about the crashed saucer had been replaced by the debunking efforts that it was only just a weather balloon. So for me, the early contactees are a reliable source. After that, a lot of misinformation, deliberate misinformation, has been placed into the minds of the public with the express purpose, with the covert purpose of confusing and scaring the public. But nevertheless, there have been testimonies of people later on who actually support the experiences of the early contactees. So in all, you have to be really very careful to decide, you know, what is real in this field and what is either planted deliberately by government agencies or just the result of people's fear as a result.
It is very clear that Mr. Adamski was highly principled man, and he absolutely refused to keep esoteric his information about his findings. And numerous times in the book, he actually appears as a very uncompromising scientist, but also uncompromising human being, truly believe in this comprehensive another world living, if I may say this way. I also noticed that it is a very important, used to be very important for him to create this freedom of information, and it seems to me that nothing would intimidate him. that he will go forward with his findings. In fact, be honest with you, the beautiful picture of him, which is indeed as a part of your book, immediately says that he was extremely, not only real, but extremely focused on these findings as if it is part of his own life. So yes. What was, how would you say he was able to comprehend the challenge of religious world, atheist point of view, scientific and political? That's a lot to hear along with your own beliefs.
Yes, well, let me first rectify. You said he was a scientist, but he would never have called himself a scientist. He had very little formal education, but that left a lot of room for wisdom. And, of course, he could only do the go on the mission that he was asked to take upon himself because of his personal experiences. He spoke from personal experience, and I believe that is the only way that he could have been so sincere and so steadfast and so unintimidated by all the attempts to bribe him, to, you know, to change his story or to keep silent or to intimidate him. There is what I document in my book, and for me that was the most fascinating part of my findings, is that he apparently went as a teenager. He was sent to Tibet. People who have studied the ageless wisdom teachings that have come through Helena Blavatsky, for instance, but also Helena Rerig, two rather well-known disciples, recent contemporary disciples. Helena Blavatsky started her work in 1875, writing books and giving talks, setting up groups and magazines, starting Theosophy, the Theosophical Society. There have been others, Alice Ann Bailey. More recently, it's Benjamin Cram from London. Starting with Blavatsky, they have introduced to the world, reintroduced, I should say, the concept, the notion that we are not an accident. We, humanity and life as such is not a chemical accident on a remote part of the galaxy. We are the physical precipitation of who we really are. We are spiritual beings. And the proof of that comes in the form of the masters of wisdom, who have always, who have always grown out of the human kingdom. Evolution, as we have been taught and are still being taught in education and in universities, is not mainly the evolution of the physical form, which was documented very accurately, I should say, by Darwin. But the evolution of the form only happened and happens as a means to a goal, to an end. And the end is the evolution of consciousness. And the evolution of consciousness is evidenced, according to the Ageless Wisdom teaching, by the existence, in the existence of a kingdom above the human kingdom. Yeah, we have the mineral kingdom from which the vegetable kingdom evolved, then the animal kingdom evolved from the vegetable kingdom, and finally, as we think, tend to think, the human kingdom evolved from that. But it doesn't stop there. The human kingdom is only a midway station, so to speak, in the long, long process of the evolution of consciousness. And the next kingdom up from the human kingdom is the spiritual kingdom, or the society of illumined minds, or the spiritual hierarchy of masters of wisdom, the Great White Brotherhood. Many, many names have been used throughout the centuries to describe these people, because they're really people like us, except they're a little bit ahead of us in evolution. And they have perfected themselves. They have perfected their lower nature to be able to express their divine source, the soul, you could say, the spark of God. And the great teachers through the centuries, some of whom are now part of mythology, but others are still revered very much in various religions, such as Krishna and Buddha, Christ and others. They are all the teachers coming from that society of illumined minds, of the masters of wisdom. And every age, one of them comes into the world to teach humanity the next step forward, the next revelation about our divine nature. And, the masters of wisdom used to live among us in the old days of Atlantis until it was destroyed because of the war that was going on at the time between the forces of materiality and the forces of light, the masters, who are the custodians of the plan of evolution for this planet. So from that time on, they lived in remote mountain and desert areas. And from age to age, they would send one of them one from their midst into the world to teach us. And one of those main centers where the masters are living, they are in many different places, but one of the main centers is in Tibet. Now, in his youth, as a teenager, George Adamski, as I document in my book, was sent to Tibet to study there with the masters of wisdom. And I uncovered an interview, a report in the Los Angeles Times from, I believe it was 1938, in which he talks a bit about that. And so he had a lot of wisdom, and it was there in Tibet that he was prepared for his task as a messenger, you could say, for the space people who are now coming into the world, not because the world needed another paranormal phenomenon, as in the coming of the UFOs, but in support of a major historical happening that is going on now. After many, many thousands of years, humanity is slowly waking up to the spiritual realities of life again. And that is supported by the return into the world of the masters of wisdom. And that is the reason for the coming of the UFOs. And George Adamski didn't really speak about the masters of wisdom in his later work as a contactee for the space people. Because his task was to inform the world about the existence of the space people, very much like it was Blavatsky's task to inform the world about the masters of wisdom. So with the coming of the UFOs, that have been spotted actually increasingly since the Second World War, and there have been several stages, and since 2007, another increase is going on. Not a day goes by without reports from all corners of the world of new UFO sightings. So it was his task to inform the world about the coming of the UFOs. And in my book, what I do is to show the parallels between the teachings that he received from the space people and the teachings coming from the masters of wisdom, as they have been given through the people that I mentioned, Blavatsky, Alice Bailey, Benjamin Krem, etc. And that gives a fascinating picture of who we are as human beings and of the path and the choice before us now.
If it would be under my power, I would open a mini university which will be devoted to you and to your teaching. Since it didn't take place yet, we continue our program. I have a very special guest with a very unique knowledge of ufology, and his name is Gerard Artson. And my next question, and perhaps my own thought, is connecting to flying objects. But before that, I wanted to mention that it just happened that on the 12th of April, we did celebrate another anniversary of a first man going into the space, and that happened to be Soviet hero Yuri Gagarin. And he was the first who indeed broke this mystery and opened the gates to the space. Now, in your book, you're talking about Kenneth Arnold, and I believe that in 1947 was noticing of first flying objects over the state of Washington. Maybe it did take place before, but I'd like you to comment on that particularly very exciting experience.
Well, yes, it's a rather well-known and well-documented episode in the history of ufology. It was, I believe, in June or July 1947 when Kenneth Arnold, who was a trained pilot, I believe he wasn't an airline pilot, but a private pilot, but he was well-trained and he had many flying hours already in his experience. So, and he was flying near or over Mount Rainier in Washington State when he saw a number of unusual flying objects doing unusual aerial maneuvers that our planes of the time could impossibly be doing. And he reported those sightings. And he actually had some drawings made, and they looked not so much like saucers, but more like, I would say, V-shaped craft, perhaps similar to the stealth airplanes that we have now. And the interesting thing is that shortly after that, airline pilots from I don't remember exactly which airline they were from, working for, had a similar sighting. And we need to remember that these pilots are very well-trained people. They can tell a weather balloon from, you know, from a cloud with a strange a light effect, or a craft, that an unusual craft that they haven't seen before. Now, they're really very well trained. Another interesting thing is that I didn't write about in my book because I hadn't come across it then, is that something very similar happened in China, also in July 1947. And I like to add that because of, you know, Kenneth Arnold, of course, is very well known in the field of ufology, as are many, many people who have been eyewitnesses, well-trained eyewitnesses to unusual, unidentified flying objects. So that makes it, tends to make it a Western or maybe even American thing that started in America, but in fact it didn't. It started. It has been all over the world from the beginning, except, you know, because of the prominent role of America in contemporary history, it has received most coverage. But I uncovered a report in a Chinese newspaper, also from July 1947, where a similar sighting was reported. So it was a global thing from the start, and the interesting thing now is that the reports from those pilots from the late 1940s, 1950s, are now also corroborated by astronauts. Even though it has taken them many years to speak out, because, you know, many of them were not allowed to speak out. But quite a few and more are coming on the record to talk about their experiences or their sightings. And you know, one of the most outspoken at the moment is Edgar Mitchell, who will speak about it whenever he has the opportunity. And I think these men are very brave, not only for what they did, you know, having been trained as astronauts and having gone into orbits after, of course, Yuri Gagarin, that you, who you just mentioned, but some of them having gone through to the moon and back. But also brave because they've decided it's time that humanity knows the truth about these things. Governments have been covering it up for too long, and they have allowed, by this cover-up, for fear to enter into the public mind when it comes to UFOs. If you look at the Hollywood depictions of UFOs or people from outer space, they are generally to do with scary missions or scary entities. And the people from space are here on a mission to salvage the planet. They're here to help us very often to clean up pollution that we are unable to control, even though it's, you know, our doing. A lot of the nuclear radiation that has been spewing out into our atmosphere ever since the invention of the atom bomb and nuclear fission technology, a lot of that goes far, far beyond the radiation that our scientists can measure. We know the solid physical plane, we know the gaseous state and the liquid state and the gaseous state of matter, but our science has not yet acknowledged the existence of four higher levels of matter. They know that it must exist because their calculations tell them they exist. That's why they say 96% of the known universe they cannot measure, their instruments cannot measure. And that's why they built this huge particle accelerator in Switzerland. And then there they're trying to prove the existence of these 96% of the known universe. But in the Aces Wisdom teachings, it has always been known that above the three known levels of matter, material reality, there are four higher levels, and they're called the etheric planes. And it is on those etheric planes that nuclear radiation has its worst effects, and because our bodies are just a precipitation of, you could say, a blueprint on the etheric planes. That's why some people can see auras, and see light around people, sometimes even with colors. And because of the pollution and the damage that nuclear radiation does on those planes, that's where our immune system gets affected and undermined, and that's why there are an increasing number of cases of Alzheimer's in ever younger people. Now, so the space people have taken it upon themselves to clean up as much as possible of that nuclear radiation, neutralize it, but they cannot do it for 100% because it is our doing, it is our responsibility. So within the law of karma, they do what they can, but we still have to suffer some of the consequences. So rather than the fear that the governments have tried to instill in our minds about the coming of the UFOs, they're really here to help us, not only with the cleaning up of pollution, but also in terms of technology and their higher sense of life and what it means to be a human being.
We're going to continue our most involved conversation about ufology, which indeed provoked me to improvise another word, perhaps inspired by your most comprehensive explanation and knowledge. So I feel that we're not talking about ufology, we're talking about humology, because I do not see any human subjects which you did avoid. On this little note, I like to have a little break, give us an opportunity to reflect on what was expressed by my very special guest, Gerard Anson, and we're going to listen to music, which will be a little bridge to our second part of extremely interesting and innovative conversation. Before our break, I created a new word. I said homology. I like to correct myself and make it a little bit more precise. I believe we're talking about humanology. I was inspired by incredibly comprehensive explanation and knowledge by my guest, Gerard Artson, who is talking about ufology, but bringing so many different issues of human life with the politics, with the science, with the history, religion, and tremendous devotion of George Adamski to another world, which in word and conviction of Gerard Artson is our world, that there is no really separation between what we know and between what we might not know, and being told in so many ways. So I guess my next question would be, to what extent you feel this is a promise that we will come closer to the truth, that we will come closer to the factual information, which will be accessible to more people? Because unless you see it yourself, it's really very hard to believe and to understand. So where we are now with what you're talking to us about?
Interestingly, it is the space people themselves who are making it easier all the time for people to know for themselves what is real or what is not real. Massive sightings are taking place almost on a daily basis around the world. It's not limited to one country or one area. In people in the countryside, people in cities, people in the west, and people in the east. Everywhere, people are witnessing with their own eyes, sometimes huge spacecraft, sometimes huge fleets of smaller craft. It's almost impossible to keep up with all the reports from around the world, and they can now no longer be dismissed as weather balloons or Chinese lanterns or swamp gas or any of the tired explanations that the authorities have wanted us to believe in for all these years. The thing we need to remember is that the UFOs are not coming here for themselves, you know, just to give us a good laugh or a good scare or make us admire them. They are here to prove the point that we are part of the universe. As I said earlier, we are not a chemical accident on the fringe of the outskirts of the Milky Way. We are a universal appearance, a universal happening, if you will. And it's just that we have lost sight of that fact, of that reality, that we are part of a cosmic brotherhood. And it is in our world, in our politics and economics, etc., it has led us to extreme divisions in our world. to the point that it's really dangerous now in terms of the competition and the greed, the poverty, the hunger is really tearing the world apart. Politics in the United States, but equally in the United Kingdom and in many European countries, everything is coming to a head where, as a society, we are forced to finally acknowledge the fact that we are all humans, we are all one, and unless we solve our differences, unless we recognize that we are each other's brothers and sisters, and we look after each other as brothers and sisters on this planet, because we only have one planet, and we have a very rich planet. There's plenty of food. There's nobody needs to go hungry, and yet we allow millions of people to die of hunger every year. And just because we have stuck with an economic system that is based on competition and greed, and politicians and economists in the West especially have made us believe that and still want us to believe that that is the only way we can rule or arrange affairs in our world, but it's not. You know, people are waking up to that fact now and are waking up to that power. If you look at what happened and what is still happening in the Middle East, that's where you see people clamoring for justice and freedom. The whole freedom movement that is sweeping through the Middle East now started in Tunisia with protests against unjustified rising of prices of food and basic necessities. It led to the government of Tunisia being swept away. And the same thing happened in Egypt, Libya. I would say it's a slightly different case, but the struggle is still going on in Yemen, in Syria, in many other Middle Eastern countries. And that is just the beginning of what we will see increase around the world. Why do I believe that?
Gerard,
we are entering...
I'm so sorry interrupting you. Reason, because we have this very dynamic conversation and you have tremendously important information, and it does stretch now to politics, history, and time. So I like to bring one thought, which indeed you expressed in your book regarding time of George Adamski. I'm going to take your text to make my point in terms of the connection of time and how relative what you are talking about and a statement of Mr. Adamski's discoveries.
Yes.
So you're saying the significance of the mission which George Adamski had taken upon himself can only be properly understood in the context of the political and scientific circumstances of his day.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to note to make it unnoticed, but because indeed you're making this very powerful connection, I'd like to ask you how this fact which I just read, according to your own expression, relates to our modern complex issues.
That's not difficult to explain. As I mentioned earlier, in the 1950s, that's when the first major sightings took place and when the first people, George Adamski among them, were contacted by the people from space. We were living in a highly divided world, yes? We had the Western Alliance, USA mainly, with the NATO allies in Western Europe, and we had the Soviet Union with its satellites in Eastern Europe. The world was completely divided. Slowly, But surely, gradually, over the years, and more thanks to Mr. Gorbachev than to Mr. Ronald Reagan, even though you know, American politicians and media would like us to believe that it was the miracle worked by Ronald Reagan, but I believe it was Mr. Gorbachev's openness to change that brought about this détente and this gradual decrease of division, the dividedness in the world. However, so it was the division in the 1950s that made George Adamski's information unique and very important, because the space people had a universal message. They said, you're all part of the cosmic brotherhood. We are here in friendship, and we can teach you, we can give you of our technology, but we will only do that if you come to terms with the fact that you are one world, one humanity, and you'll have to sort this out as a human family. You're not going to have, in an ordinary family, you're not going to have, say there's a family of six, you're not going to have two people eating everything and then leaving the crumbs for others, as we are doing now. And because of the coming to power of the neoconservative view of life, with its extreme emphasis on economic values and monetary values, since the election of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in the UK around the same time, we've actually increased that dividedness in the world again, that separation. Greed and competition are now, through the market forces, are ruling the world. And even though there is enough food for everyone, millions of people are dying just because they don't have the money to buy it. And if you look at humanity as one family, that doesn't make sense. That's the biggest crime that you can imagine. And George Adamski was asked to give us the message, a message of hope, that we are one family and that we should pull together and we should recognize our oneness and act on it. But the world fell back to its old ways, and still, you know, there's every hope for the world, because as I indicated earlier, the UFOs are not here for themselves. They are here in support of the main, the most historical event that is happening now, and that's the return into the world of the Masters of Wisdom. 2,000 years ago, we had Jesus, who came to inaugurate the age of Pisces. This time, there will be a new teacher to inaugurate the age of Aquarius. Every roughly 2,000 years, our solar system, and therefore our planet, comes into alignment with a different constellation in the zodiac. And each constellation conveys on us its own characteristics through the cosmic energies coming from that constellation. That is not astrology or some kind of fantasy, because science now knows that really energy is all there is. We live in an energetic universe, and energy travels long, long distances throughout cosmos. So according to the Ancient Wisdom teachings, the characteristics of the previous cosmic cycle, that of Pisces, that was inaugurated by Jesus 2,000 years ago, they were the characteristics of individuality and devotion. And we can see that in our devotion to ideals, to political parties, to religions and everything, but that has divided the world. The new dispensation, the new energies that have been coming in over the last couple of hundred years, and that are now almost in balance with the old energies of Pisces that are withdrawing, they have as their characteristics unity and synthesis. And they need new structures to be expressed, to express themselves. Of course, all our structures now, political, economic, educational, scientific, etc., are the result of our response to the old energies. And we now have to find ways to respond to the new incoming energies. And it is those that response that I was alluding to when I spoke of the people power movement now going on in the Middle East, but earlier, 20 years ago in Eastern Europe. It's a surge in human consciousness, and that is triggered by the return into the world of the Masters of Wisdom, and at their head, the master of all the masters, the world teacher. His personal name is Maitreya, and it is that historic event that the UFOs are here in support of. When Maitreya is known in the world, when the world teacher will be known in the world, and when he will be reintroducing to humanity the Masters of Wisdom, his brothers and our elder brothers, you could say, that's when we will realize again our connection with the rest of the universe. So it's a most important time and most exciting time that to live in.
Well, I have a slight suspicion that you probably would be feeling much more comfortable to live in the hands of a solar system. But since we're having you with us in our planet, and it looks as if you still have enough to do here, could you tell us who you are? What is your, I hate to use word background, but what is your childhood? And what truly brought you to this aspect of life, such a passion, knowledge? And I just could not refuse to ask this question, particularly because our program coming to the end, but you gave tremendous honor and respect to George Adamski. In fact, I have to be honest with you, when I, for the first time, took a look at the book, I thought I'm going to interview Mr. Adamski because he's the name, but the position of his first and last name is on the top of the book. Letters are much more pronounced than your name. So I would assume that you are quite humble man with truly a vast amount of knowledge and a passion for your subject, with a devotion to this findings of George Adamski and his space brothers. But we really like to know who you are.
You're very kind. I don't know if I have a lot of knowledge, but I did a lot of research, and many people who have all kinds of opinions about George Adamski don't care to look for the facts. And I really went to his publications, I read everything, even his very obscure publications that not many people knew about. I'm just an ordinary person. There's nothing really extraordinary from my childhood that I think would be interesting. I work in Amsterdam as a teacher. I'm a teacher trainer, in fact. I train students. I teach students to become teachers of English. And I became interested in George Adamski through my study and research of the teachings of the Ageless Wisdom. As I indicated, the books by Helena Blavatsky, The Secret Doctrine, that was followed on and elaborated on to a great extent by Alice Anne Bailey between 1919 and 1949, 30 years. Fascinating books with all kinds of esoteric facts about life. And as I was building a catalog of those teachings, I also came across the work of George Adamski. But there was such a fierce debate on the internet about his sincerity or his alleged hoaxes that I decided to look into it myself and go to the source and look at the the things that were written about him by people who worked with him and his own work. And that led me to find these very interesting parallels between the teachings of the Ages Wisdom and the teachings coming from space, from the space people, through George Adamski mainly.
Well, I just so fascinated by the fact that whether everyone who listened to this program will believe to the factual aspect of your knowledge or not, but there is a certain quality in your self-expression which suggests that your knowledge is touching so many substances of human life. It certainly provokes to most important questions about the future of our planet. It certainly makes one even more responsible and more aware about the beauty which is more and more difficult to preserve. Certainly your book, which is written, by the way, with absolutely incredibly intensely expressive English, I frankly felt reading your book that every thought and every sentence has its own value, its own position in your big picture. So I wanted to thank you so much for bringing this mystery of the world to the real ear, to the real attention, to the real intellect and emotion. And I wanted to wish you to continue to go on this road, to bring more fascination to the world, more reality, and more things which we can use to preserve and to treasure the world we're living in.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to be on your show, and you've been very kind, and it was a pleasure to talk to you, Lina.
Thank you so much, and I hope we will be in touch. I'd like to follow up with your research and writing. And on this note, we will say goodbye to my very special guest, Gerard Artson, who was kind enough to give his time and knowledge all the way from Netherlands. And certainly the ocean could not disturb this fantastic technological connection, which permit us to have this very interesting, unusual interview. On this note, I will invite my listeners to listen to another little piece of music, after which I will say my conclusive words and wishes to all of us. Few moments to say goodbye to all of you, to thank you for your time, tune in to the program, to my wonderful station with PBS team, and I will look forward to see you on the air next Tuesday. That was Lina Mirmont with my program Lina Live. Thank you. Mm-hmm.